if it's Tuesday, we must be on the left bank in Paris.
Yeah, you can almost hear the accordions in the background.
Or the sirens.
We were just out and about having an important...
Flaneuring.
We were having an important pre-podcast meeting in a very nice restaurant. And so far, in like about half an hour, people have come up to John and gone, "Oh, you are Karl Marx. Oh, you are Victor Hugo."
Yeah. It's great.
So
you can have a permanent stand here at the bookshop.
I'm totally coming to live here.
It's definitely. You can live
all
here.
All I get in London is men coming up to me saying, "What do you use on your beard? Do you use oil? Can I touch it?" No, you can't touch it. Yeah, I'm afraid. It's Shoreditch. It's impossible to go out.
And so we're sitting in the library, and the library is open.
The Sylvia Beach Memorial.
Where we're going to do the intro. I'm just interested. It's open to people to come up and browse, and can they be allowed to
normally
borrow
when there aren't podcasts? No, it's open at all times. I mean, the bookshop's open 7 days a week, 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. And George, who founded this bookshop, was very intent on keeping a sort of non-commercial side of the bookshop. And so the whole of the first floor, apart from the poetry corner, are books that are just here to read.
I think anyone who comes here... I came here for the first time in 1981 when I was 18. And it was before I'd been to university, so I was doing my usual... And it lodges somewhere in your head, this place. I mean, I haven't been to City Lights, but I'm sure that's the same. Mm. And I ended up being a bookseller. And I'm sure in some part of... And I don't know what you feel about this, Andy, in some kind of... The sort of Waterstones ideal that Shakespeare and Company was
partly, but also I can't pretend I'm something I'm not, John. You know, W.H. Smith
not
W.H. Smith and Croydon is my cradle. That's my, so it would have been lovely to have Shakespeare and Co. as an inspiration, but we didn't really have one.
Days of Waterstones, when we used to talk about the bookshops that inspired us, and John Sandow and Shakespeare and Co. and City Lights, Tattered Cover, all these bookshops. Venerable institutions came up. I mean, I have to say, I don't think many of the Waterstones came anywhere near. Although there were one or two.
The early one.
Yeah, they one or two. I mean, I think, you know, at its best, High Street Ken and the brilliant Robert Topping's brilliant bookshop in Manchester.
Bath
had some good...
It does
feel, in that slightly pretentious way that one has, but, you know, that great line about T.S. Eliot had about a place where prayer had been valid. I do feel this is a place where reading has been proved valid. You know, that over generations of people, you do feel there is almost a kind of a sense of it being a shrine to a certain kind of values, reading, literature, things that matter.
Well, let's go ahead and desecrate the shrine.
Yes. Are we going to do this?
Let's go.
Okay. Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. This show is a special edition, as we've decamped from our usual berth around the kitchen table of Unbound, the website which brings authors and readers together to create something special. Instead, we're gathered around a rickety table in the first floor library of the legendary Parisian bookshop, Shakespeare and Company, looking out from the left bank over the Seine to the front of Notre Dame. As a view, it's hashtag not bad. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound.
Oh dear. And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today are Adam Biles. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Adam is a writer and novelist, and his book Feeding Time is published by the Galley Beggar Press. Adam is an expat Englishman, and he has lived in Paris for the last...
Almost 13 years.
I noticed that you were described in The Guardian, Adam... as, quotes, a megawatt talent. that's spelt W-A-T-T, not W-H-A-T. Also, Adam works here at Shakespeare & Co. Mm. And last year I did an event here a year ago, which was huge fun.
God, where I knew you were going to bring this up.
Yeah, you did. You had a year to be ready. he and I both undertook to, at the suggestion of a customer in the shop, to read... The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. I read it the next day and thought it was amazing. Adam, what did you think?
I don't like to be told what to do. So a whole crowd shouting at me that I will read The Little Prince.
Didn't work.
Didn't work.
I'm so sorry.
Shocking. That's one of our top three sellers as well.
It's really good.
I've never read it. And Dan Kieran, you know, my co-founder on that, it's his favourite book in all the world.
Not being funny. Have you read it, Sylvia?
Yeah, I've read it a long time
ago. Okay, so we're both saying to the other two members of the party today, you should read it, it's really good. Have you read it?
Yeah, I've read it.
Matt's here as well, everybody.
I could draw an elephant.
And alongside Adam is Sylvia Whitman. Sylvia is the proprietor of Shakespeare & Co., a role she started helping her father, George Whitman, with in 2003.
Yes.
Is that right? And when did your father move into these premises for Shakespeare and Company?
He opened Shakespeare and Company here in 1951.
Ooh.
He arrived in Paris in 1946 on the GI Bill, and he moved into a hotel on the Boulevard Saint-Michel, and he left his hotel door open at all times, and he filled his room with books. And at some point, his friend that he met here, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, said, "George, you know, you really should open a bookshop, because you're just stuffing this hotel room with books and people are hanging out here, but, you know, it's getting a little small." And so he found this amazing space here, which is it's a 17th century building opposite Notre Dame. It's a really magnetic part of Paris.
Totally. I feel like I'm sitting in, we're here in the library, and I feel like I'm sitting inside of the perfect backlisted listener's head. So I can look up, I read up from where I'm sitting. I can see books by Winston Graham. I can see As If by Magic by Angus Wilson.
Nicholson's Ghost by John Gardner, a book I've always wanted to read. I mean, it's Henri Consul, Graham Greene, just in the corner.
Upstairs, there's a copy of Dentistry and Its Victims.
Oh, is it on the third floor?
Yeah. Have you read it?
There's such an eclectic... No, I haven't read that. It's not even on my list, but there's such an eclectic mix-up there.
A lot of medical textbooks as well.
Yeah, which, next to Stalin biographies and...
Which Burroughs referred to quite a lot, right?
He did, yeah.
Because
he was
researching and writing.
Yeah. On the naked lunch.
And you have a cafe here, and you have the antiquarian bookshop next door.
Yes, we have. Yes, you don't need to leave. We're trying to make it a space where, you know, we will lock people in, especially writers, for a long time. No, we have the cafe we opened 2 years ago. And surprisingly, because last year was quite difficult after the attacks,
of course,
we were very nervous about the fact that we just opened a cafe. But actually, it brought us a lot of French customers, and it really saved us last year, which was fantastic.
It's great coffee as well.
And good coffee.
So the book that we're here to talk about with Adam and Sylvia is A Rebours, Against Nature, Against the Grain, depending on how you translate it, by J.K. Huysmans. So we're going to come on to that in a minute. But John, I have to ask you, as is traditional, even though we're in Paris, let's not talk about being in Paris. What have you been reading this week?
I've been reading a collection of stories published last year by Jesse Greengrass with the brilliant title An Account of the Decline of the Great Auk According to One Who Saw It. We were talking earlier, Andy, but there's an amazing... seems to me that there's been an amazing renovation of the short story in I know everybody says that this is happening and then it goes away again, but I think there are a group of younger women writers who've published amazing debut collections. I'm thinking about Atrib by Ely Williams, who we talked about. I'm thinking about Pond by Claire Louise Bennett. The Joanna Walsh, who was a guest on Backlisted. But Jesse Greengrass, it's that sort of crackle of excitement when you read someone. The stories are very, very strong in this collection. They're not all equally strong, but her use of language, her precision, it's as good a first collection as I can remember reading. And it's been a very, very good year for first collections.
When was that published?
It was last year. It's won the Edge Hill Short Story Prize, and it also won a Somerset Maugham Award. She's just about to release a new novel, which I've read, which is also brilliant. So that's I know that's always the difficult second album problem. You've done a collection of stories and how about a novel? Well, she's made that transition. That novel is called Sight, and this was a John Murray original. Very, very good editor at John Murray, bringing out, I think, a lot of really strong and interesting debut collections. But the stories are I mean, they range from the opening story, which is a very powerful sort of briny account by a sailor of the horrific destruction of the great orc. I mean, these birds were unable really to fly, and they were I'll read a tiny passage in a moment to give you a flavour of it. There's a sort of, I was thinking of things it reminded me of, there's a theme of isolation and coldness and salinity in the book. There's an amazing, very Huysmans story about a woman who is imagining, she's got different lives for herself, including being an observer of polar bears in Svalbard, mm-hmm. In that sort of way that Huysmans imagines going to London and doesn't actually get there. There's an amazing account of Paracelsus, the kind of alchemist, 16th century alchemist, drinking in taverns and challenging people. I mean, she does historical, she does contemporary. Two of the stories are set in the future in that kind of, and again, I'm thinking of Sarah Hall, another mm-hmm. great short story writer, her Madam Zero collection that we talked about. There's a brilliant story set in a call centre. I'm going to read a tiny little passage from that as well. It's about class. There's a great last story where a woman goes back to... She takes the train journey back. It's called Scropton, Sudbury, Marchington, Uttoxeter. And she basically... Her parents were greengrocers, and she goes to a public school, and she's embarrassed by the fact that the greengrocers sort of lies about. And then she has midlife crisis and ends up taking the train journey back and stands in the pouring rain for about 4 hours outside the greengrocer's shop and has a sort of... I mean, the book's very... It's about the precariousness of self. One story, there's a man whose whole life, he starts to see ghosts, and more people die, and more ghosts sort of, they don't really say anything to him, but they're just around. He has to sort of live through them. So the connection past, present, history, it's a really, really ambitious first collection. But let me read to you, I'll read two really short bits just to give you some flavour. This is towards the end of the account of the decline of the Great Orc, the title story. Here is the truth. We blame the birds for what we did to them. There was something in their passivity that enraged us. We hated how they didn't run away. If they'd run away from us, we could have been more kind. We hated the birds. When we looked at them, we wanted nothing more than to smash and beat and kill. We felt in them a mirror of our sin, and the more we killed of them, the cleaner we became. Sometimes we would be 2 days at the killing, or three even, and we wouldn't sleep. We would keep at our slaughter through darkness with the light from the fires only, and in the morning, the bodies thrown from the cliffs would cover the sea for yards around the rock. The eggs we trampled, dancing across them in our boots. No matter what we did, the birds stayed huddled to the rock, waiting for us to reach them. This is why we killed so many of them, because of this way they had of watching us. This was why we killed so many more than we needed, without thinking about what might happen next year. This and the way their numbers deceived us, making us think there could be no end to it, but we could go on and on forever. It was a kind of madness they caused in us, and afterwards we would be exhausted. On the way home, we wouldn't talk about what had happened, but only about how much money we could make from the feathers. But alone with ourselves, we blamed the birds.
Wow.
She writes sentences, and you don't get this very often, but you think, I don't know why I bother. I mean, really, really incredibly assured. Just very, very quickly, and then, because it's just a totally different thing, it's a much shorter bit, this. Just to say about the woman in the call centre. I tried to sound like someone who's answered the phone in the bath, or like someone who was worrying that what's on the stove might burn. I tried to sound like someone who was afraid of flying. I tried to sound like Columbo. I tried to sound as if I was successful and in control of myself and my destiny. Sometimes I try to sound like an old-fashioned Hollywood starlet. I lower my voice to a whisper and make it deep and husky and fill it with breath. I try to sound as if every word I utter is an invitation. I try to sound as if what I'm saying is laced with eroticism. In this voice I say, can I take the long card number? I say, we can also offer you insurance from as little as 99% per month. I say, have you tried turning it off at the wall. That's the end of the story.
Oh, that's so good.
So she is a real find, and I think she'll, you know, in that sort of terrible football manager way, I think she'll go all the way.
Do we think that we've talked about short stories quite a lot on Backlisted, and we like reading short stories. I think bookish people like reading short stories.
Yeah.
Do you feel there is a kind of short story renaissance going on? Is that making its way out into the world?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're always popular. I mean, I don't know if the renaissance in as much as I'm not sure they ever really went away.
No. But there is a sort of feel, there was for many years, and there might still be, that people don't buy, the public do not buy volumes of short stories in quantity.
Well, worse than that, I think it's that publishers don't commission them, and I think maybe that's changing a little bit. We get a lot of story collections coming through at Unbound because it's a classic way of somebody starting, because you tend, I suppose the way you tend to start writing is a lot of people start with short stories because I do feel that with the Jesse Greengrass to an extent. Some of them feel like exercises in style, but there is a kind of the quality of the language is so good. And I mean, and a range, I think somebody's just trying out different registers, different characters, different historical periods.
I do feel there's a renaissance, because I'm with you in that there was a few years where publishers were struggling to sell mm-hmm. the short story collections somewhere.
Well, traditionally I think volumes of short stories would be published by novelists between novels. Right,
what have you got?
Stuck.
Yeah. Okay, well, but actually, I think there is a change. I think writers who specialise in the short story are more prevalent now than they were 10 years ago.
And I think a trip, the Ely Williams, for example, that was such a brilliantly thought through. The way that there are also sort of collections where the stories are kind of connected. You're the Fernanda.
It's funny you should say that.
Good, because Andy.
Yeah,
what well have you done. Been reading?
I've been reading a book by a writer called Eve Babbitt, called Eve's Hollywood, which was republished a couple of years ago by NYRB Books, our friends at NYRB Books, and it's sort of fiction, but not fiction. It's clearly highly autobiographical fiction. They're not even short stories; they're sketches, and they're about Eve Babbitt, or someone very like Eve Babbitt, who has changed the name to avoid certain repercussions, I suspect, growing up in LA. And Eve Babbitt is a kind of, she's a journalist, a writer, she's written fiction, non-fiction. She designed album covers for The Byrds, Buffalo Springfield and Linda Ronstadt.
Wow.
She's kind of, there's a very famous photograph of Marcel Duchamp playing chess with a naked woman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's the naked woman.
Wow. Okay.
And she gets mentioned in the same breath as Joan Didion, Grace Paley, Renata Adler. So Eve's
and
Hollywood.
Is this a first collection?
I think this was her first book, yeah. She went on to write another novel called Slow Days, Fast Company, which was published in the late 70s about LA. This one is kind of sketches LA in the 50s and 60s. She writes about her high school. She writes, there's a brilliant piece in here, a sketch of Gram Parsons when he fell in and then fell out again with Keith Richards. She's wonderful.
A bit Candice Bushnell, but
yes, I think so. Yeah, and so I'm just gonna. I just got a couple of little bits to read because she's so good. She's so funny, and she's got such an eye for a one-liner. The opening chapter is called "Daughters of the Wasteland." The wasteland being in LA, it being LA. She says, I don't remember how old I was when I first heard Los Angeles described as a wasteland or seven suburbs in search of a city or any of the other curious remarks uttered by people. It was never like that for us growing up here. For one thing, there was always so much going on, so many different people, and my mother's constant soirees and, and my mother's constant soirees and dinners. Wasteland is a word I don't understand anyway, because physically, surely, they couldn't have thought it was a wasteland. It has all these citrus trees and flowers growing everywhere. I know they meant culturally, but it wasn't. Culturally, LA has always been a humid jungle alive with seething LA projects that I guess people from other places just can't see. It takes a certain kind of innocence to like LA anyway. It requires a certain plain happiness inside to be happy in LA, to choose it and be happy here. When people are not happy, they fight against LA and say it's a wasteland and other helpful descriptions. Vera Stravinsky once told me that in 1937 she went on a picnic in a few limousines. Isn't that clearly, isn't that brilliant, right? I'll start, hang on. I know. This is such a good story. I don't want to build this up. It's going to a very good place, right? Vera Stravinsky once told me that in 1937 she went on a picnic in a few limousines that Paulette Goddard had prepared, quote, because she was quite a gourmet, unquote, Vera said. And on the picnic were the Stravinskys, Charlie Chaplin and Paulette Goddard, Greta Garbo, Bertrand Russell and the Huxleys. They got into the cars to drive to a likely spot, but there were no likely spots, and they drove and drove. There had been a drought, and everything was dry. There was no grass. And so finally they spotted the measly LA, quote-unquote, river, and decided to spread their blanket on its ridiculous banks and make the best of it. The LA River is a trickle that only looks slightly like a river if there's been a downpour for 3 months, but even then it doesn't look like a river. Anyway, they spread out the food, the champagne, the caviar, the pâté and everything, and sat on the banks of the river beneath a bridge over which cars were going. Hey! They looked up, and there was a motorcycle cop with his fists on his hips, looking cross. Yes, Bertrand Russell stood up to inquire. There was a sign that said people were not allowed to picnic by the river. The cop pointed at the sign, looked at Bertrand Russell, and then said, "Can't you read?" If the story's details are different, if it was another year and the Huxleys weren't there, still, it is an LA wasteland story. It's a story of LA. The cop only relented when he recognised Garbo. So it's terrific. She's so good. She's got such a there's a brilliant one-liner here. She's talking about how much she writes a whole little chapter about Lawrence of Arabia, how much she loved Lawrence of Arabia. She's trying to work out why Lawrence of Arabia grabbed her so much, and she says, why is there only one Lawrence of Arabia and why isn't it still playing? I could kick myself for missing that first year. It was all those Academy Awards which made me so wary. Someone should have told me it was good. So, and then she has a brilliant chapter, and I'll just read a tiny bit. Matt, you can always get rid of this. Get rid of it, but we're enjoying it. Called The Hollywood Branch Library, where she talks about, and it's this seemed appropriate, what books meant to her, the books that she loved. And John, she has so many good little one-liners in here. She says, my education has been through reading, which has been my salvation and backbone throughout life. The time I wanted to kill myself in New York, Dombey and Son saved me. Charles Dickens is perfect for accidental hit bottom. Anthony Trollope is too, but he's so divine that it's a shame to waste him just because you're in trouble. It's another bit. I'm just going to read a couple more. This is so brilliant. Virginia Woolf is hard, but I've done it. And we did an episode about Virginia Woolf a few months ago, so that resonates. Virginia Woolf tantalises me. I wish I could write like that. She is in love with London and I am in love with LA, but London has seasons and this giant history and strata of society. Virginia Woolf wouldn't like LA. But maybe she'd forgive me for loving it anyway. The Waves is the best she's written. You go crazy, it's so perfect. And then it was her A Room of One's Own that made me believe in women's lib. I never liked it when Gloria the Crass and Gross was trying to write about it. It was like reading that radical propaganda where the words are so poorly selected and so divorced from humans that you have to really discount your eyes to be able to let what they're saying get into your head. But when Virginia Woolf does it, it's easy. She's right and they're wrong. And she's got another couple of things.
Oh, I love that description of like how
this book is so good. I mean, this is just pure enjoyment, man.
Is it
just
a reissue
so good.
Or what?
Yeah, it's a reissue. It's from the early 70s.
Great.
And it was out of print for 30 years or something, 40 years.
The picnic scene just sounds like some sort of really niche fan fiction.
Can't you read? So we've got Chapman, we've got the Bertram. Who else should we invite?
I've read Proust all the way through because everyone said I'd like it. But Colette's little sketch of Proust coming into a room after everyone had thought he'd gone and already had begun gossiping about how he was a fag was only about three paragraphs, and you could simply imply the other 9 million pages. Nevertheless, I like the other 9 million pages, and I recommend them to anyone in solitary confinement or otherwise out of commission who can't read Proust at the laundromat. And last, I think, but not
that's
least...
That's a T-shirt.
And last, I think, but not least, is Henry James. When I grow up, that's what I want to be. Henry James is just right. Not too simple like Dickens, not too impossible like Proust. Just right. And my cousin tells me, she's reading that enormous biography of him that just came out, that he was always going out to dinner and to parties. So when I grow up, I can still have fun. I don't know about being celibate, though I don't want to, and nowadays it would ruin your reputation. And Henry James always understood the spirit of the times.
Very good.
And that's what Eve Babbitt's. You read Eve Babbitt's for the for the spirit of the times, late 60s, early 70s LA, as one would read, say, Joan Didion, perhaps. But unlike Joan Didion, Eve Babbitt's has got the
LA,
brilliant one-liner.
You're not happy in yourself, then LA's a nightmare. If you go into it with a naive, it's exactly right.
Mm. Well... And that this point, at which point the delighted laughter comes screeching to a halt.
We've talked about books enough. Now for some capitalism.
So we are now going to switch to talking about Against Nature, Erebor by Joris Carl Huysmans. And as is traditional on Backlisted, Adam.
Yes.
Where were you when you first read this extraordinary book?
I was in Paris. I'd only just moved here. My brother was living here at the time as well. And we had fallen in with a couple of friends. One Irish guy called Gerard, one French guy, Jean-François, you knew him as Jeff. And this sort of atmosphere, we were all big readers already, but this sort of atmosphere built up between the four of us of this kind of weird sort of literary one-upmanship, you know. And I think probably a little bit of that pervades this podcast as well. You want to recommend the next big book, the next book that is going to sort of...
The next stoner.
Yeah.
The one that's going to surprise somebody, shock somebody. And so, for example, I remember Jared recommended Céline to me for the first time, and that was just something which completely blew my mind. Blaise Cendrars was another one. L'Autre Monde, people like that. And then Jean-François, one day, I think it came out of a conversation of sort of literature that has a physical effect on you. And I remember him giving me the Erebor and saying, this one will make you sick. But almost as a way to recommend it, you know. It's going to leave you feeling nauseated. Yeah, it's going to leave you feeling stuffed in some way, but you're going to love it. And that was the first time that I read it. And he was right.
I'm going to state my interest right now. I read this book for the first time in 2006. It's one of the 50 books that I read for the Year of Reading Dangerously, but I ended up not writing about it. I have one of these weird things that happened when I was working on that book, that there were books that, as I was reading, I was thinking, oh, wow, I can't wait to write about this. I've got so much to say about it. And then when it came to the finished book, there wasn't room because it didn't fit in the narrative that I was trying to put together. So I never ended up writing about Against Nature. But I think this is just... I'm reading it again and reading some more Huysmans for this Backlisted. I just love this book so much.
I'd never read it, but like it's one of those books that you can't read anything about the development of the novel and the development of actually all kinds of things, kind of French Catholicism, the development of decadent art, symbolism, Mallarmé, modernism. It's one of those books which has, it's an important kind of sort of navigational point for the development of modern literature. So you have an idea of what it's about, mm-hmm. but as it were, getting my hands in and kind of circling around with it and reading it for this podcast, it's everything that everybody always said it was. It's completely unlike anything else that I can think of, although it has some... It's, on one level, a nightmarish version of that Channel 4 show. What's it called? Grand... What's it called? The one that... The house makeover thing with...
Grand Designs.
Grand Designs. it's sort of Grand Designs set in the seventh circle of hell.
That's amazing. I love that.
What are you doing with this room? This room. It's also, on another level, a bibliomemoir. I love what he says, and we should talk a little bit, obviously, about Huysmans, but I love what he says about it. He said, as I thought about it, the subject grew, requiring painstaking research. So each chapter in this book, in a way, is a kind of an imaginative essay, or a sort of trippy kind of phantasmagoria. So he says, each chapter contained the concentrate of a specialised subject, the sublimate of a different art. Each chapter condensed itself into a meat essence of precious stones, of perfumes, of flowers, of religious or secular literature, of profane music or of plain song, and certainly painting as well. So it is like that. It's a novel about a man who...
It's got no plot. It's got almost no plot.
Basically, like, yeah. does up his house in the most insane way, and thinks about going to London, leaves, and then comes back. Then he gets ill. I mean, I don't think there is a spoiler problem here. He gets ill.
No.
And then he finds one of the most unpleasant ways of getting over his illness, which is to do with he has dietary problems. And so he, instead of eating, he starts to have meat enemas, which is... I mean, if I were Graham Norton, I would be... You were talking on Twitter this year about somebody boiling your piss, Andy, which is a great... I mean, this is a book...
This year, yeah.
But this book it must be the first really proper kind of angry rant against... as a sort of fictional character. I can't think of many books that where the invective is more brilliant. It's so dense and so rich, the language and the scholarship in it is just remarkable.
And just one of the things I absolutely love about Huysmans is he is the master of spleen.
Yeah.
And I'll just read you this tiny amount because it seems appropriate. It's about a character called Desessent. That's right, isn't it, Adam? How's my pronunciation?
Desessent.
Yeah. Thank you. Not Des, as in Desessent.
Who we should say is the sort Desmond of the last sort of the last sort of slightly diseased kind of scion of a kind of an aristocratic family.
Mm-hmm. Who may or may not have resembled Huysmans himself.
Yeah. Money.
Or Baudelaire.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the relationship between Huysmans and Baudelaire is a very, you know, is again fraught with interest. Desessent dropped these people and sought the society of men of letters.
Oh, yes.
Imagining that theirs must surely be kindred spirits with which his own mind would feel more at ease. A fresh disappointment lay in store for him. He was revolted by their mean, spiteful judgments, their conversation that was as commonplace as a church door, and the nauseating discussions in which they gauged the merit of a book by the number of editions it went through and the profits from its sale. At the same time, he discovered the free thinkers, those bourgeois doctrinaires who clamoured for absolute liberty in order to stifle the opinions of other people, to be nothing but a set of greedy, shameless hypocrites whose intelligence he rated lower than the village cobblers. His contempt for humanity grew fiercer, and at last he came to realise that the world is made up mostly of fools and scoundrels. It became perfectly clear to him that he could entertain no hope of finding in someone else the same aspirations and antipathies, no hope of linking up with a mind which, like his own, took pleasure in a life of studious decrepitude, no hope of associating an intelligence as sharp and wayward as his own with that of any author or scholar. Mm-hmm. And that, my friends, is on page 8. He puts his foot down on page 8. What happens is Desessent... Utterly sick of the world, takes himself in, leaves Paris, takes himself into seclusion, attempts to, as you were saying, John, distill pure aesthetic experience and fails.
I mean, the core being the idea that nature was a unimaginative, you know, repetitive old bore, and that the great thing was the human imagination, and that not only could the human imagination match anything that nature had to offer, it actually could transcend it.
This is the beginning of an essay, very short beginning from a wonderful book called Parisian Sketches, which was published before Against Nature. And this is about the Bièvre. It's like somebody's written an impressionist sketch of the canal that runs through Camden. Okay.
The Bièvre, which no longer exists.
Which no longer exists, right?
Or rather, it runs underground.
Anyways, and what you were saying, John, this is you know, we're in the age of nature writing, as you know. This is what Huysmans has to say on the topic.
And his favourite.
Nature is interesting only when sickly and distressed. I don't deny her prestige and her glory when, with a fulsome laugh, she cracks open her bodice of sombre rocks and flaunts her green nipple breasts in the sun. But I confess I don't experience before these sap-induced debaucheries that pitiful charm that a run-down corner of a great city, a ravaged hillside, or a ditch of water trickling between two lank trees inspires in me. Fundamentally, the beauty of a landscape consists in its melancholy. Now that's some nature writing I can get behind.
And to add to that, he asks in the book, or rather Desessant asks, does there exist anywhere on this earth a being conceived in the joys of fornication and born in the throes of motherhood who is more dazzlingly, more outstandingly beautiful than the two locomotives recently put into service on the Northern Railway?
Yes, I know. And then he goes on to point these sort of erotic descriptions of these. I mean, it's properly bonkers, this book, but bonkers in a kind of... I wonder if this, you know, it's the appât à la bourgeois, that kind of anger against sort of... I know it's there in Swift, but it does seem to be one of the... This is one of the great angry books.
Well, France has a great tradition, doesn't it, of appât à la bourgeoisie from...
Molière.
Molière, Huysmans, Gainsbourg, Welbeck. We're going to come on to Welbeck because of the links the between Huysmans and Soumission.
That's when I read just a few paragraphs of this book in French, was when it kind of came back in conversation with Welbeck's Submission.
Yeah.
And it's like you said, it's so striking, the language, the richness, and the it's very flowery and very kind of... It made me think somehow a little bit of Georges Perec, Les Choses, you know, the detail. It's like the opposite of what Zola does in plunging you into social context. It's very much...
He really, really upset Zola. I mean, Adam, maybe we should do a little bit more context about the book and where it came from, because it did...
Well, I want to ask Adam how he felt reading it again, because you read it again for us.
Yeah, so this was the third reading, and actually I'm not a big rereader generally, so... This could be possibly the only novel I've actually read three times. And I started reading it in French because I thought I'd already read it twice in English. I thought after 13 years, I'd give it a go.
And you translate it.
Yeah.
Your French is pretty good.
It's all right. But after probably about 15 minutes, I decided I wasn't going to get very far with it.
It's
incredibly dense, incredibly florid... French, and also he, as I think we're going to talk about later with Andy, like this, he coins quite a few words as well. So when you're not 100% stable, let's say, in your appreciation of a language, you're not entirely sure whether he's leading you up the garden path or whether it's just your inadequacies with a language that
I will say. I mean, we were talking about this. The thing that shocked me the first time I read this book, and shocks me on rereading, and I think is one of those things which gets marginalised in books like this, but it is extremely funny.
Oh God,
yeah.
And it's meant to be funny. Mm-hmm. You know, the film director Bruce Robinson, the gentleman who wrote and directed With Null and I.
There's a lot of With Null in
this. This is his favourite book, mm-hmm. and he says this is the funniest book ever written.
Amazing.
And I certainly think there are 3 or 4 set piece chapters in against nature. Mm-hmm. There's a, I mean, they're the famous ones. John, you mentioned one. There is a chapter where, inspired by reading Dickens, Des Esseintes decides that he will travel to London. Yeah. But what happens is he just goes to a restaurant in Paris, and by the end of eating his meal, he thinks, "Oh, I've probably had the English experience," and goes home again.
But this whole book is about this. It's about that all you need is your imagination and some strange aids. I mean, we can talk to. I mean,
the mouth organ.
He plays music. He kind of basically all the instruments in the orchestra are assigned a different spirit, and you can. Mm-hmm.
It's a synesthetic mouth organ.
It is.
Right. But what's so brilliant about Huysmans? And also, we haven't talked about that. There's a chapter four, is a chapter where Huysmans orders his jeweler to encrust his pet tortoise with rubies and diamonds and magnificent stones. Yeah. And at the end of the chapter, he notices that the tortoise has died and can't stand all the weight. I mean, it's one of the most brilliant comic set pieces. But and here's the thing that's so brilliant about Huysmans. Several other writers, including Zola, who was one of his inspirations, André Breton, say the thing about Huysmans is he's inviting you, he's brave enough and bold enough to invite you to find him absurd before he points out the absurdity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's a real method to it. Mm-hmm. If he's making you laugh, he also really means it at the same time.
Similarly with his flowers as well. So he decides, originally he decides he's a fan of artificial flowers, obviously because artificial flowers can supersede nature. But then he decides what he'd rather have are real flowers that resemble artificial flowers. And so he goes about ordering in, finding the ones that the real flowers that look the most artificial. And then when you're reading it, you think, well, these are going to die. this is going to sort of fall apart within a few days. And then he sort of remarks upon this a few pages later and seems quite surprised by the fact.
I know. There's a famous description of the black dinner in the book as well, where he's sort of making stuff out of black things, having black meat. But I love, there's a sort of the mad kind of obsessiveness of this. This is instead of going to the seaside, okay? There, by salting your bath water and mixing into it according to the formula given in the pharmacopoeia, sodium sulfate, hydrochlorate of magnesium, and lime, by taking from a tightly closed screw-top box a ball of twine or a tiny piece of rope specially purchased in one of those huge ships' chandlers whose enormous warehouses and basements reek of sea tides and seaports, by sniffing those fragrances which will still cling to the twine or piece of rope, by perusing a really good photograph of the casino and zealously studying in the Gijon a description of the beauties of the seaside resort where you would like to be, by letting yourself be rocked in your bathtub by the waves made by the bateau mouche as they pass close beside the pontoon. Finally, by listening to the moaning of the wind gusting under the arches of the bridge and the rumbling of the omnibuses as they cross the Pont Royal just a few feet above you, the illusion of being near the sea is undeniable, overpowering. Absolute. It's just a man in his bath sniffing bits of rope, looking at photographs, pretending he's in the seaside. I mean, there's nothing. I don't think there's anything in literature up to that point quite as mad as that. I mean, it is a totally. It's and yet at the same time, you know, we'll talk about the he ends his life, obviously, not just as a Catholic, but as an oblate, as a.
But that's it as well. It's the delight in the artificial,
yeah,
and this celebration of it. Like, even when he's deciding what colour to paint his rooms, he decides against painting one of them purple because he says it is possible to see purple by ingesting a specified amount of santonin, and thus it becomes a simple matter for anyone to change the colour of his walls without laying a finger on them.
So it's mad drugged up, and then it's flowers, and then it's amazing gemstones. Mm-hmm. And the whole, I mean, it's every sense, as you say, that synesthesia, senses sort of swapping out for one another.
What's so interesting about this book is that it has retained its power to, as you were saying, actually make you feel sick or shock you in different eras. When it's published, it's seen as a reaction against naturalism, against Zola. It's described famously as a breviary of the decadence. It's as a decadent text that Oscar Wilde discovers it, adores it, makes it one of the motive in the plot of the Portrait of Dorian Gray, that Dorian Gray, this evil book, this decadent book, falls into his hands and corrupts him. It seems to be corrupted. It's not published properly in English until the 1950s.
Really?
And is then adopted by the 60s generation as this kind of anything goes text. Marianne Faithfull says in her autobiography that the way it worked in the 60s, she says, she literally says this, she says, you know, we would say to somebody, have you read Erebor? And if they said yes, you'd fuck them.
That's still going. My friend Chris Sullivan, who was in Blue Rondeau Turt's 80s, you know, wag club. It's one of his favourite books. He wrote an essay saying, you know, it was he didn't know whether Bowie had read it, but he was pretty sure Bowie had read it because Just Ascent is a There is that sense of the outsider, the person who just doesn't want to be like everybody else, who can't stand. I mean, the final jeremiad against the bourgeoisie in this book is one of the great sort of bird flipping moments in literature.
The first time I read it, and indeed reading it again, I don't know what you feel about this. I felt it was a book, you know, like I say, it speaks to different generations. Mm-hmm. It felt like a book about consumerism.
Yeah.
Completely.
So modern, you know, the idea of somebody who is able to get whatever they want, to have a surfeit of everything, and what spiritual effect does that have? They're empty. He exhausts it. He's left with... He throws himself on the mercy of the Catholic Church. That's how the book ends.
And when it was published, wasn't it? Didn't he become a sort of figure that everyone wanted to be like?
Erebor fell, this is him writing 20 years afterwards, Erebor fell like a meteorite into the literary fairgrounds, exciting both stupefaction and anger. The press were thrown into total confusion. Such ramblings and ravings had never been seen. After describing me as a misanthropic impressionist and calling Des Essentes a maniac and an imbecile of a complex kind, the academics like Monsieur Lemaître waxed indignant because I did not sing the praises of Virgil. And it goes on. In all this hurly-burly, only one writer saw clearly, Babet d'Orvier, who incidentally did not know me at all. And then he goes on to say... The great line that he says, after such a book, the only thing left for the author is to choose between the muzzle of a pistol and the foot of the cross.
There it is.
Love it.
The choice is made.
So it was immediate success when it came out.
Yes, yeah. It's a huge success. It's scandalous. It defines the particular era. It wouldn't be an episode of Backlisted if I didn't mention...
The Bruckner moment.
Anita Bruckner. As luck would have it, Anita Bruckner in her... Actually, her book, The Genius of the Future, but republished here in Romanticism and Its Discontents. She has an essay about Huysmans. I'm just going to let...
Of course she does.
We normally do the biographical thing about Huysmans. I'm going to say, he was born in 1848. He died in 1907. He lived up the road from where we are now, for the most part of his life. Never married. And then I'm going to hand over to Dr. Bruckner. This is how she introduces Huysmans in a single paragraph. The most brilliant of the critics, the most ardent of the disciples, the most outrageous of the solipsists, and the most sadomasochistic of the romantics was J.K. Huysmans, whose desire to be not only Baudelaire, but Edmond de Goncourt and Zola combined, overtook him at an early age, but was discarded when his moi pointed out to him a more excruciating form of self-denial. The story of Huysmans' career and his life is a series of novels that move from naturalism to decadence to Satanism in Labat to a trilogy of novels based around his conversion to Catholicism. And Bruckner describes it as a Calvary. It's a spiritual autobiography spread through 30 years of writing fiction. I also just want to bring to your attention this magnificent book that I read last week, The Life of J.K. Huysmans by Robert Baldick, which was written in 1955, published in 1955. Absolutely incredible book, one of my favourite books that I've read this year.
Was it published alongside the Chase translation?
Yes, it was. Yeah. And he describes it thus. He says, besides their interest and importance as human documents, Huisman's novels have considerable historical significance, since each of his major works epitomises some vital phase of the aesthetic, spiritual or intellectual life of late 19th century France. Thus, Avalot, The Missal of Minor Misfortunes, is permeated with the pessimistic spirit of the post-war years and impregnated with the ideas of that period's favourite philosopher, Arthur Schopenhauer. Arabor, which Simons aptly called the breviary of the decadence, expressed the tastes and aspirations of an entire generation of writers and artists, and its hero, as Gustave Geoffroy observed, embodies part of the soul of the dying century. And he goes on to say how he moves through en route and then to the cathedrale, and then he talks about his what he calls Huisman's remarkable style, which his former friend Léon Bloy picturesquely described as, quote, continually dragging mother image by the hair or the feet down the worm-eaten staircase of terrified syntax. But he says it's deliberate. It's a deliberately heightened, slightly gamey, that's the word.
Yeah, well,
the medicine and food are the images that he's constantly drawing on.
I love the way he just turns. He just gets cross. He doesn't like bars. Just decides he doesn't like bars because bars are not as good as brothels. And that actually, at least in brothels, you know what you're going in for. But the girls working in bars were as stupid, as self-seeking, as base and as self-indulgent as the women who worked in brothels. Like the prostitutes, they drank without being thirsty, laughed without being amused, went into raptures over the caresses of a common labourer, maligned one another and scrapped with one another without the slightest provocation. In spite of that, the youth of Paris had never yet observed that as regards beauty of form, skill of technique and desirable attire, barmaids were clearly inferior to the women cooped up in the luxurious salons of brothels. My God, thought Des Esseintes, what fools these fellows are who hang around here. Quite apart from their idiotic illusions, they even manage to forget the risks associated with damaged or dubious merchandise, to no longer take into account the money spent on a lot of drinks the landlady charges for in advance, or the time wasted in waiting for the goods whose delivery is deferred so as to enhance their value, or the endless shilly-shallying used to prompt and promote the sport of tipping. It's like, you're not getting your shack. You're just getting a drink and you're paying for it.
I'll come on to this in a minute. Adam, what do you consider that your writing has been influenced by this?
If you'd have asked me that before I reread it, I would have probably said mildly, but not enormously. But there were some scenes that particularly, I think, because a lot of my writing is kind of people on their own, not necessarily sort of isolated in, in a building like Des Esseintes, but sort of, for example, in Feeding Time, the director is sort of a recluse in his in his study, and there are scenes which are almost sort of unconsciously. I can't remember which chapter it is. There's one where Des Esseintes, it opens and he's lounging in his chair and he's reflecting on something he's recently been up to. And there is a chapter in Feeding Time that opens on almost exactly the same tone.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I can't say it crossed my mind at all when I was writing it. But there's something to do with that sort of. Certainly, I think turning the volume up to 11 in a way at certain moments.
I mean, I'm interested to know how it's sort of its status in France. I mean, it seems to me that there's something brilliantly French about the way he becomes a Catholic. I mean, and that there's a very sniffy essay that T.S. Eliot wrote about Baudelaire, you know, sort of saying he was man enough for damnation, but in a sort of Anglican-y way, you can't imagine quite the same transition. The essay that he writes 20 years after, when he looks back on the book, and he basically says, I was right about pretty much everything except for that chapter, the number six chapter, where I corrupt a young boy portrayed him to be a murderer. I probably wouldn't write that in the same way now. But otherwise, he's basically kind of unrepentant. He's just saying, I was just training. This book was just a staging post. It was an amazing phrase he used about God. He says, God was digging holes to lay his wires, which is just, that's what he was doing with the book. So he's able to sort of justify and defend his book not just as a Catholic, but as an oblate, somebody who is, essentially gone into monastic orders, but still living in society.
And in France, Arabour, I assume, is still read. But I was reading something saying, La Bas is the book here in France, that's the witch, Satanism, yeah. is the one that's best known. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Very French.
And actually, I was looking at the just our, we have quite a big French literature and translation section here, and that's the title that we sell most of for him. Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting.
What's the one you were telling me about the country? Oh, that's what I want to read.
Okay, so the book, so he has a huge, we're publishing people. He has a publishing phenomenal success with Arabor. 3 years later, he follows it up with a book called On Rad, where a couple move to the country and have a terrible time because all the local peasants who they think are going to be marvellous rustic H.E. Bates types rip them off.
Disappoint them.
And it's interspersed with these extraordinary dream sequences, some of the most obscene dream sequences imaginable. And at the end, guess what? It's a failure, and they come back to Paris. it's the Huysmans narrative. It's the attempt to withdraw, to find something, be it a rural idyll or an aesthetic height or extreme Satanism, mm-hmm. and coming through it and going, there's nothing. There's nothing. There's perhaps spirituality. And towards the end of his life, Huysmans died in a particularly lingering and unpleasant way. But he felt that there was nothing more to write about because suffering was the thing, expression of faith. Yeah. And therefore that's where he had been going all that time.
I guess if you're case of the prosecution, you know, there's a sort of a vein of misogyny that mm-hmm. runs through the book. Mm-hmm. You're either some mad goddess, kind of Salome. Mm-hmm. There's an amazing, quite erotic scene. A lot of the artists like Gustave Moreau and Odilon Redon, which he kind of popularised through his through the book. But there's that. Then all there's the so it's whores or kind of goddesses.
But also, to be fair, there's not many books where a man hires a ventriloquist to come and throw her voice into a sphinx and read Flaubert for his sexual gratification. So I'm not sure what category that falls into. Niche.
I wonder if that's a bit to do with the decadence in itself, though. That's sort of in the sense of, you know, decadence and this decline, it's sort of the end of nature, the end of sort of the overcoming nature. And I guess in a way, to somebody who's committed to that, the figure of woman will sort of, in a sense, will represent the continuance.
Well, it seems to me, weirdly, it is a very strange devotional text. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a very odd religious book.
Absolutely.
And I think if you read it as a sort of, if you read it in that way, and if you looking backwards on it, it's the absolute antithesis of a sort of, he hates at one point, utilitarianism is his idea of a nightmare. I mean, it's a very extreme, spiritually intense. So, you know, all that sensory, it's there in mm-hmm. in the tradition of self-mortification in the mm-hmm. church, from that the senses need to be engaged and stimulated to the point of excess, almost to get to that sort of religious insight.
Mm-hmm. We talked a bit about Soumission by Welbeck. Welbeck's last novel, very controversial last novel, less remarked upon aspect of it is that the protagonist mm-hmm. is an expert in Huysmans. Mm-hmm. And I realised when I went back to this book, having reread Against Nature and read Robert Baldick's book, that you can read Soumission as an extremely ironic version of the Huysmans' journey. That Welbeck's protagonist has a moment of spiritual awakening, deeply ironically, mm-hmm. when he converts to Islam because he's totally lost faith in Huysmans. that's the story of the book. And there's a bit here by Welbeck. If you're playing Andy Miller bingo at home, you'll realise that I've managed to include both Welbeck and Anita Bruckner in this. But
have you got the kinks in yet?
I haven't quite. I just want to read a couple of paragraphs. So the book starts with a description of Huysmans and studying Huysmans. He says, Welbeck's protagonist says, "The academic study of literature leads basically nowhere, as we all know." unless you happen to be an especially gifted student, in which case it prepares you for a career teaching the academic study of literature. It is, in other words, a rather farcical system that exists solely to replicate itself and yet manages to fail more than 95% of the time. Still, it's harmless and can even have a certain marginal value. And then he goes on to say, how do you follow Arabor? The obvious answer is with great difficulty. Indeed, On Rad, which follows Arabor, is a disappointing book. How could it not be? And yet, if its faults, its air of stagnation and slow decline, never quite overcome our pleasure in reading it, this is thanks to a stroke of genius on Huisman's part to recount, in a book bound to be disappointing, the story of a disappointment. The coherence between subject and treatment makes an aesthetic whole. It gets pretty boring, yes, but you keep reading because you can feel that the characters aren't the only ones stranded in their country retreat. Huisman's is stranded there too. It would almost seem that he was trying to go back to naturalism, the sordid naturalism of the countryside, where the peasants turn out to be more abject and greedy even than the Parisians. Oh, and so on and so on. I mean, you know, that's wonderful. So, Adam, is this a good place to start with Huisman's, do you think?
I think it's the only place to start with Huisman's, to be honest. It's, I mean, none of his books are going to be easy, I think, and none of them are... I think maybe Labat is a bit more narrative driven.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, it just sort of, it the reputation of this book overhangs Huisman's as a writer so heavily that I don't think, sort of all of his other books in a sense gravitate around it.
I think it is completely exhilarating. Mm-hmm. I think it is a totally, we overuse this word here, but it is remarkable, and it is extraordinary, and it is unique. There is other... Most books are like other books. This is like no other book.
There's one moment where he's talking about Moreau in the text, actually, and he says, with no real ancestors and no possible descendants, he remained a unique figure in contemporary art. And that sentence really stood out to me as something that could equally be applied to this novel, if you want to call it that.
If it's that, absolutely. Yeah, who knows what it is?
Who knows what it is? But he found the piece. So this is the best defence of literary elitism. It's just a really short. He said, he's basically this idea of you could boil it down, a novel you ought to be able to boil down by taking out all the ridiculous, superfluous descriptions, boil it down to a tiny couple of pages. Thus condensed into one or two pages, the novel would become a communion of thought between a magical writer and an ideal reader, a spiritual collaboration of a handful of superior beings scattered throughout the universe, a treat for literary epicures accessible to them alone.
And that's what's so, you know what's so interesting about that? That is Joyce's definition of the perfect reader. Who are you writing Finnegan's Wake for? A reader who doesn't exist, who is able to comprehend what I'm trying to do.
Well, it was there, and that sense of, you know, the universe, God paring his fingernails, and the writer being the kind of, that sort of, the writer as priest. It's there in Eliot as well, you know. But should we end with...
Adam, could you give us another gamey extract from the book?
Yeah, I marked quite a few, actually, but I think maybe just to kind of give an example of the kind of, in a sense, the underlying absurdity, but also the... sort of the beauty of the construction of this book. This is quite near the beginning. This is the beginning of chapter two, in fact, where he sold all of his goods. He's moved into his
his designs,
and he's trying to figure out how to essentially eliminate as much of the exterior world as possible. So here we go. Beginning of chapter two. After the sale of his goods, Des Esseintes kept on two old servants who had looked after his mother and who between them had acted as steward and concierge at the Chateau de l'Orp while it waited empty and untenanted for a buyer. He took with him to Fontenay this faithful pair who had been accustomed to a methodical sick room routine, trained to administer spoonfuls of physic and medicinal brews at regular intervals, and inured to the absolute silence of cloistered monks, barred from all communication with the outside world and confined to rooms where the doors and windows were always shut. The husband's duty was to clean the rooms and go marketing, the wife's to do all the cooking. Des Esseintes gave up the first floor of the house to them, but he made them wear thick felt slippers, had the doors fitted with tambours and their hinges well oiled, and covered the floors with long pile carpeting to make sure that he never heard the sound of their footsteps overhead. He also arranged a code of signals with them so that they should know what he needed by the number of long or short peals he rang on his bell. And he appointed a particular spot on his desk where the household account book was to be left once a month while he was asleep. In short, he did everything he could to avoid seeing them or speaking to them more often than was absolutely necessary. However, since the woman would have to pass alongside the house occasionally to get to the woodshed, and he had no desire to see her commonplace silhouette through the window, he had a costume made for her. He had a costume made for her of Flemish fay with a white cap and a great black hood let down on the shoulders, such as the Beguines still wear to this day at Ghent. The shadow of this coif gliding past in the twilight produced an impression of convent life and reminded him of those peaceful, pious communities, those sleepy villages shut away in some hidden corner of the busy, wide-awake city.
Oh, my God.
It's so funny. Oh, brilliant.
There's a bit of Royston Vasey there. It's just the madness, isn't there? Put those felt shoes on. I don't want to...
But in a weird kind of way, it also makes
me think... Let me talk you through the keys.
But it made me think of Tom McCarthy's Remainder in that sort of obsessive attention to detail.
I don't think we're going to get anywhere any better than that as a place to end. And if all we've done is made you think of Erebor as a... comic, a classic of comic literature. I think it is. It's a great book.
This is one of those books that we occasionally do, like when we did Under the Volcano.
Yeah.
You know, that it's there's only one of it.
Yeah.
And whatever it is, like I said earlier, exhilarating is the word. I find it hilarious and thought-provoking and boring in places because he wants it to be boring.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when he's doing the history of Latin, you know, interminable history of a period of Latin literature that really nobody much cares about.
And then he drops into peptone enemas.
Yeah, yeah, the peptone
enemas.
Meat enema. On that savoury gaming note, we should stop. Thanks to Adam and to Sylvia and to the glorious Shakespeare and Company in Paris, to our producer Matt Hall, and thanks once again to our sponsors Unbound. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at BacklistedPod, on Facebook at Backlisted, and on our page on the Unbound site, which is now unbound.com/boundless/backlisted. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another show in a fortnight. Until then, au revoir.
La comédie, c'est fini.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.